This week on Decentralize, biohacking and biotech, a future in the garage, proprietary technology in agriculture, and Erwin Goldman of the Open Source Seed Initiative.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
So we talked a few episodes back about farm tech, actually, which is something we don't normally talk about in this show, but it was a really fun conversation. However, we didn't really go too far into what makes it so interesting to us and the parallels to the software industry and to the application for decentralization, a lot of the biotech and agricultural tech research which is going on. But Eric, you recently brought to my attention some interesting trends in an article you saw that was kind of making the case that biotech may actually be really the next field for open source and kind of decentralized access in terms of research, in terms of innovation and entrepreneurship. Why do you think? Why do you kind of agree with that? And what are some projects you see out there which you think are embodying this kind of move that make this topic relevant to us here on the podcast?
Well, so I think the biggest trend that we're seeing is the democratization or the increased availability is perhaps just a longer but more apt phrase. The increased availability of technology used for research in general and development of technology. So like computers have historically just gotten cheaper and cheaper, for example, and the more hands that you have computers in, the more people are creating and the faster the rate of change in terms of technology-related things. With biotech, even research materials for like performing your own blood tests and doing genetic breakdowns and building your own lab, all of that stuff is getting significantly cheaper due to a number of innovations in the chemistry space and all sorts of things. So what's happening here is we're seeing a lot of parallels between software, where more people doing software means there's more good software being produced, also more bad software. Similarly, this article, which is really interesting because they're saying you might end up in it with a case where you could have things like garage labs where just your average sort of grad student level researcher can simply acquire enough materials and things to basically run sufficient tests just without having to have the massive funding that was historically required. And so we're seeing the decentralization, if you will, of requiring massive institutions to aggregate people, and people have to go to those institutions, be employed by those institutions, and be subject to the intellectual property assertions of those institutions, to people being able to do a lot of this stuff on their own. And moreover, sharing of data. So I sort of mentioned there the intellectual property obligation. So when you go to work for a university, most universities, you work in one of their research labs as a grad student. You work under your research director, who's probably your advisor, your PhD advisor, right? And any work that you do actually gets owned and copyrighted by the university because they're technically your employer, right? You're doing work to them. For them, you're working underneath their pay, so they exhibit certain controls as to what you can do with the innovations that you create, or even simply, maybe there's no innovation, but rather the data that you're producing from your experiments. They generally, maybe it gets published, maybe it doesn't, and then those journals actually you have to pay to get access to those journals. This really came to a head for me, sort of in terms of my philosophy on it, when I saw Aaron Schwartz. Aaron Schwartz basically, he had a long history of finding data that was locked up and made unavailable, whether intentionally or not, and making it available so that insights can come from it, and specifically targeting things that would provide societal or social good. There was actually a very specific cancer therapy that was developed. I think it was a cancer therapy. I think it was actually a way of detecting cancer early that emerged from a researcher at a university out of a specific data set that he published, which came out of the data that the JSTOR release, which was the big FBI case that, you know, and the MIT case that actually led to him committing suicide. And there was a researcher who came out and said that he had collected data out of the JSTOR database that he wouldn't have been able to otherwise see that is absolutely integral to the success of his research. So the reason this article sort of stood out to me was it's an increasing trend. We're starting to see there's historically has been like this back pressure, especially in the most recent years, against these journals locking up data and information. Well, what this article points out is that people are just more and more not even relying on that data, and instead of like trying to open up all the existing data, are just going and producing new data and open sourcing the Human Genome Project. There was one that I learned about that I didn't know anything about, called the International HapMap Project, which is pretty awesome, and it's like this open source database of genes and, you know, specific like changes in those genes that cause different traits and behaviors. And I just think overall, the more available this type of information becomes, the faster innovation, research into treatments and even cures of various diseases and syndromes can be. It's just going to happen faster and faster the more available you make the information.
I have to agree with that observation, Eric. It's something interesting about anything viral, and it's fitting we're talking about viral stuff since we're talking about biotech, is I think just about anything that's gone viral in the past 10 years since the rise of, you know, sharing sites, sharing platform for sharing things as significant as information or as silly as the Gangnam Style video, is that copyright is loosely enforced, and there is a general culture of remixing and sharing, and that does seem to be having an effect here in the biotech field. And just for our listeners who are curious, and we'll include this in the show notes, the title of the article is Biotech in the Garage by Seth Bannon, just so you know our show notes for this week. It's quite an interesting article, too, and I don't know if I mentioned this on, I think, episode 34. One of the talks I saw at the Teal Summit, which I was really fascinated by, which I kind of unintentionally wandered into, was a talk called Gene Therapy in the Garage by Matt Schultz, I think, of Immusoft, which is a biotech company, I think, based in California, that's working on some really interesting open source hardware applications for people to actually, I believe something to do with introducing altered genetic material into their bodies for like local isolated treatments. I'm not a medical professional. I'm not probably representing it best, but we'll certainly include a link to their work in the show. But I just found it absolutely fascinating. I mean, there's something about biotech, about working with a material of life that's really complex, really engaging, really scary, and also really potentially like powerful that I think working with software doesn't always have. Obviously, it's really interesting and really complex and really unpredictable systems that can come out of innovation in the software world, but even more so in biotech, it seems.
And as a follow-up to what Eric was saying, and I think it's almost a throwback to how things were, you know, maybe 50 to 100 years ago, because this idea, I mean, obviously in universities and institutions always conducted research, but a lot of the greatest inventions or creations happened with a guy in his garage, right? Just, you know, just creating something crazy and, you know, studying any data he could get a hold of via institutions or not, and it really is a throwback to that, and you know, the accessibility of this data makes it even better, and the open source mentality makes it better and easier to gather, and it's just a win for everyone.
Most definitely, and you know, I think with just with any kind of project, we talked about 3D printing on this show, we've talked about open source software on this show, obviously, but with any kind of thing we're seeing now, the decentralization that really matters is actually basically enabling anyone, like you said, in the garage to pick this up and start doing it. And that's a really interesting thing. I mean, we obviously can't provide enough resources on the show to give people the stuff they need to go out and do it themselves. That's certainly for more specialized research to do, which is why we have them on our show. But when you look at things, like especially in the medical field, which is really fascinates me, fascinated me about that talk in San Francisco, is the fact that you're looking at an industry that for so long been very closed off in terms of information, in terms of research, sort of very authoritarian in the relationship of patients to doctors. It's culturally authoritarian in the sense that, like, we don't really think to ask about our own health and our own, you know, healthcare. We kind of assume it's left to the experts. And now it's not exactly entirely true. 23andMe is an example of this. It's a company where you can actually get your genomes sequenced and, like, your personal genetic history. You can see, you know, what proclivities you have maybe towards certain diseases. It's kind of a get a basic map of sort of of who you are as a person fundamentally. I think they've had some serious licensing issues with the FDA, and they were fined heavily, but I think they are getting back up and running. But they're a great example of this, that they're really providing, like, the individual person, the person who doesn't have a whole lot of specialized knowledge, the ability to go in and understand more of themselves, have far more control over their medical care. In other cases, whether it's agricultural tech or other areas of biotech, just have more control over the things they're working on locally. It's not necessary for us anymore to necessarily be specialists. There's always going to be a role for them, one of those roles being interviewed on Decentralized. But I think it's cool. It's far more possible to have way more direct local control over your life through biotech and through software equally, but also to participate in making that software and making those advancements in that technology.
I think one of the other cool things here is the funding mechanisms. It seems like not only because the materials are getting much easier, like we're starting to see people being able to do the stuff on their own, yeah, but we're also seeing things like traditional incubator and accelerator models start to emerge here, where there's targeted advisorships, groups of people who will bring in idea stage or just prototype stage projects, will give them enough funding to pay for their project and just pay them directly to help see it through fruition. And this is a model that is applied in the software industry, especially in the past like 10 years, with startups, software startups, technology startups. I think we're going to see, there already are a few of these cropping up, that are just funding these smaller projects that individual maybe they already have graduated, maybe they have a reasonable set of skills, or maybe they just have a good idea. And the second thing that's interesting to me is that I actually think that Einstein has this fantastic quote. It is that we can't solve problems using the same type of thinking that created them. And I think part of this hyper-specialization, especially in the existing academic model and in biotech, and in a lot of industries, like you can see this replicate itself everywhere, where hyper-specialization actually is a detriment to the progress of that space, because everybody is trained to think the same way, trained the same presumptions, and there's no sort of approach that just comes from a different model. There's a lot of discussion in academia over the past couple decades of, you know, cross-disciplinary study and, you know, forcing this function. But I think some of the best innovation comes from people who know little or nothing about a space and come in thinking of it just completely with a fresh set of eyes and have never seen these problems before. And that lets you break the mold and that rhythm of just the way that the current industry has been thinking, and I think that's really important.
Absolutely. You know, a new idea and a new way of thinking of things is really what spurs everything. And, you know, it's funny because James sent something really funny. Someone mentioned Jurassic Park and GMO dinos, but you know what? Those are the kind of things that will influence someone to maybe look into this more. Maybe they won't figure anything out to bring dinosaurs, but they might, you know, get really interested in genetics. They might really get interested in, you know, the preservation of the knowledge that's there, and who knows, you know, who knows what can inspire the next person to do this kind of thing. And it just is a completely different field than I think we're used to talking about, which is why I like it. And it's also something that has a lot of very grand, what did I say, grand consequences or grand effects, because I don't know if consequences is the right word, on everything we do, the single thing we do.
Well, I think I can tie this together. I had never have understood this whole GMO debate, right? Like, it is completely uninteresting to me, and I'll tell you why. Are we going to have the same sort of, like, moral pushback, the media pushback? And I think the answer is yes. When we start, genetically modifying humans, right? Like, well, when we start doing real gene therapy, which is going to happen, genetically modified organisms, is there a difference between genetically modified plants and then genetically modifying humans to eliminate disease, right? Like, that's it's isomorphic, it's fundamentally the same thing. And that's, I don't know if anybody's seen the latest Jurassic Park movie, Jurassic World, but it's kind of based on that, so.
No, it's interesting. This is probably the one, every field of technology has this doomsday scenario. I've been thinking a lot about, just how, horrifying, really, honestly, atomic weaponry and nuclear technology is. But it also has its upsides. AI has its downsides, or at least strong AI. Dinosaurs also have their downsides. And it's interesting, too. I mean, there's really cool stuff going on, I think, with woolly mammoth genetic material. They're able to at least, I think reintroduce some traits, perhaps, of the woolly mammoth. In there's some genetic compatibility between modern day elephants and mammoths. It's quite interesting. Google it. Maybe we'll find a link for that in the show notes. But there seems to be a lot really possible here. It's really fictional and fantastic. And what's cool about biotech is I think that writers back in the day, like Jules Verne, they probably couldn't really imagine software. It really wasn't on their radar in the same way. They had early computation and everything, but they could imagine fantastic creatures and stuff. And maybe we'll get that. Who knows? Maybe that's what makes biotech really interesting as a science and field of technology.
Go ahead, Eric. Sorry.
I don't know how we're ever going to get to my transhumanist ideal future if we don't get to this point where we actually start modifying humans. And I think it's an inevitability. People's moral concerns, it's not any centralized authority's job to tell us what our morals should be. And if somebody wants to do this, they should be able to. Because quite frankly, I for one am excited to be able to, eliminate my or increase my cellular regeneration rate so that I can go exercise and perform better and be awesome and get smarter just through literally modifying my genes. And that is the next level. That is transhumanism. That is the ability. It will change our identity, and that's what everybody's afraid of, right? But I, for one, am excited to move forward and start becoming something better than what we are today.
You know, Eric, if you use performance-enhancing technologies, we'll have to kick you out of the Podcasters League. It's very much against the rules and customs.
Olympic-level testing.
That gives me more of a reason to do it, right? Breaking existing rules and customs. We've got to come at this from a new angle of thought.
Yeah, and when you said that about breaking rules, and I think what you said a minute ago, yes, there will be huge controversy when this happens, and it will be way bigger than GMOs because people fear what they don't understand. And as soon as you do something like this, it's basically challenging everything they know about humanity. And even though they can easily figure it out themselves, maybe not easily, but they can figure it out themselves, most choose not to, and they choose to question and say that it's not right. So I think that's going to be an inevitable dialogue. That's going to be the abortion debate of 50 years from now.
And it's interesting, Eric, and Eric and Tony, before we even get to the point of being able to modify humans, we kind of have to be able to modify other physical things and machines and robots. And right now, and this was covered a little while back and kind of struck up a controversy, but right now you can't even modify your tractor if you're a farmer, or at least so John Deere kind of wants to occur. They applied to the U.S. Copyright Office recently for DMCA protection, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, 1998. Very damaging and harmful source of many of the modern day iterations of IP that we've seen in software. What most people don't know that is that a lot of tractors, a lot of vehicles, GM's part of this application as well, or part of the same kind of movement, do run on software, or at least have a software component. I mean, obviously, I think a lot of farmers use GPS steering for tractors. They even have sometimes like really modern entertainment systems built on their tractors. So what John Deere wants to do with this is actually basically extend DMCA protection to prevent farmers from routing around the technical protection measures in the tractors, so like DRM, et cetera. But it would also extend to modifying the hardware itself. So like if you're a farmer, you want to repair your tractor, you want to add something to it, make modifications, the kind of tinkering that's gone on for like centuries for farm implements is actually going to become a matter
illegal.
Of licensing. Yeah, well, illegal. I mean, I don't know the exact measures they're laying out as far as litigation goes, but the way they're approaching it now in terms of legal terms is that when you buy a tractor from John Deere or when you buy a car from GM, you're getting a license for the full lifetime of the vehicle, but you don't really own the vehicle because it's so... The line between the hardware and the software is becoming so blurred, and it's true. That's happening with a lot of things. I mean, like, and we have to expect it's going to be the trend for the future is that even as we modify ourselves, that line between the software and hardware is going to become really blurred really fast. So it's kind of like, yeah, it's pissed me off. Go ahead.
It should piss you off, man. One of my favorite memories as a kid was going to the state fair and seeing the tractor pulls, right? And it's people, not necessarily farmers, but they're literally taking tractors and souping them up and making them really powerful and strong, right? And that was a lot of fun. And now that activity, like making your tractor better, is going to be like illegal. Are you kidding me? But no, on a serious note, look, like you're literally trying to prevent innovation here. Like this is direct innovation. This is the same behavior that IBM exhibited. This is the same behavior that any established monolith is going to exhibit. And would we have, you know, the modern farming equipment that we do today if farmers didn't try everything that they could to try to squeeze more value out of their land? No, because that's exactly what drives innovation, is this the desire to extract value, the desire to extract wealth from an asset, right? And if you now have this company trying to make the government make it illegal to modify and improve upon these things, all of society will collapse if anyone ever follows that rule, right? Like, innovation will stop, we'll never move forward. Like, we can't rely on our overlords to innovate for us.
What we can do, though, is kind of look back and learn from history. And when you said the DMCA, what a bad piece of legislation. Somehow a bunch of old, out-of-touch people that were decision-makers in 98 were convinced by the entertainment industry that piracy would kill it. And they passed this legislation, and now, I think it's funny, I wish they knew about the ramifications. And I think they were warned of the ramifications then, but they just didn't understand it. And this is what happens when... You know, you can, whatever you feel about government, it exists now. We have to live in reality. And you have to say, okay, do the people that are elected know exactly what's happening here? Some do now because younger people are getting in there and they're forcing to educate themselves, but many still don't. And, you know, it really does just, it hurts. And it makes me pissed off that when there was an issue where they were trying to make the jailbreaking an Apple iPhone illegal. Like, there should be a clear distinction on modding hardware versus modding software, at the very least.
No, I think they should be treated the same, and it should be perfectly legal. Good question.
I agree with you in
principle. Why do we elect, pretty much the only people we elect are lawyers? Why are the only people we elect lawyers? Why don't we elect, like, scientists? Why don't we elect engineers? Why don't we elect... Actually, you know what? Screw elections, because we're never going to fix this broken system.
This is true.
It's the incentive problem. It's not going to be fixed by electing certain people.
And businessmen. You forgot about businessmen. They're high up there, too, and know who they're elected.
Well, there's no incentive for a computer scientist to go run, right? Like, there's no incentive for, you know, a mechanical engineer or a physicist to go run. You damn well better believe they understand these things better than a lawyer does.
Yeah, absolutely they do. But you're right, there's no incentive.
To the good and hardworking lawyers out there, by the way. It's a profession. But I think that we need much more. If we're going to have a government at all, again, I don't believe in that, then it needs to be a much more diverse representation of the population.
Yeah. Well, I think the one part of the population that's probably hurt the most by this, and maybe should be the focus of this, and at least for me, is sort of that farmer, tinkerer, local mechanic variety type person. And we don't think about them very often, I guess, because they're not always making the huge technological leaps forward. But it's funny. Like, I think it highlights the difference in philosophies here. If we assume John Deere and GM to have philosophies, which they kind of represent in John Deere's application, you kind of see it represented of like the sort of the lone genius inventing something totally from scratch and springing it on the world and getting his just desserts through that intellectual monopoly. But oftentimes, a lot of really cool improvements happen when people are just tinkering on stuff. I mean, it's a great way to learn something, first of all. It's also a great way to build on the knowledge that people have contributed. And I think that's really going to be limited here, but there seem to be alternatives that are emerging. I mean, people are moving toward open source hardware in agricultural fields, and by that, I mean they're going and buying older tractors that don't have computers in them. So as long as that option exists, I think it's a pretty... it's pretty cool, and to see the other open source options for farmers and for everyone, people who don't necessarily know about software, but you can learn about this stuff, it's pretty fascinating.
Today we're joined by Erwin Goldman, who is the department chair and professor of horticulture at the University of Wisconsin and the chair of the Open Source Seed Initiative. Erwin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, tell us and our listeners about what is the Open Source Seed Initiative?
Well, the Open Source Seed Initiative is a relatively new project that was developed by a group of plant breeders and farmers and seed savers that was inspired by the open source software movement. And the idea behind the initiative is to create a pool of seeds that will remain free and remain in the public domain in perpetuity, and those seeds cannot be harnessed to be patented or licensed or in any way tied down by any form of intellectual property protection. So it's a kind of a protected commons for seeds.
So I'm very interested, Erwin. Is there anything in your background, I guess, that sort of inspired you and your colleagues to look at the open source movement for this? Obviously,
yeah.
Sort of very, very much associated with software, but how did it become tied to agriculture?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. You know, I'm a plant breeder, and I've been involved in plant breeding for 30 years, and at the beginning of that time, we were all able to freely exchange seeds. I mean, I could get seeds from a colleague. I was able to send seeds to anybody who asked, and over the decades, it has changed completely to the point where my employer, the university, or a private company that is involved in plant breeding will seek to protect the seeds through patents and licenses, and so most of the seeds are not available unless you're willing to sign a licensing contract. And the effect that has in plant breeding is rather chilling, because if you can't really get seed freely, you're less likely to use it. And if you're not going to use it, then you can't really improve crops for the things they need to be improved for. So we were, for years, thinking about this issue. I mean, there wasn't any easy remedy for it until we sort of thought about open source software, and we thought, you know, this is a model that we might be able to use. It's actually been quite challenging to pull it off, but we're working on the mechanism, and I think we've now found a way to actually make it work.
And when you just said it was challenging, I would imagine so. I was fascinated by the project because it's seeds, it's things we all eat, you know, that's very useful to everyone involved. And, you know, I think you touched on it a little bit, but I want, if you can, go into a little more detail about how intellectual property has harmed this more, and what do you think caused that to become, the intellectual property to become a much bigger deal when it comes to seeds? Because whenever we talk about it, it's usually regarding digital content, not something that grows from the earth.
Right. I mean, you wouldn't normally think that something like it would even be patentable. And in fact, it wasn't until 1980 that a U.S. Supreme Court decision, a very famous decision, made it possible to patent any living organism. that was a microbe, and about 1984 saw the very, very first seed patents being issued. And today there are literally thousands of patents not only on genes and plant genes that are important in agriculture, but patents on varieties, things that we never really imagined could happen, but the way that the case law has gone makes it possible for people to get such patents. In addition to the patents, there are a number of restrictive licenses that come along with seed. And even home gardeners may even find these on seed packets today. Certain seed companies sell packets of seed that say on them, by opening this packet, I agree to the following conditions. Some of those conditions include that you can't save the seeds, you can't use them in breeding, you can't share the seeds, that sort of thing. So the seed amounts to a one-time rental of the seed, which is really kind of a strange thing given our sort of long history of agriculture for 10,000 years, to the point where you buy a packet of seed and you really don't even own that, you're just renting it. So a lot of these things, I think, have contributed to the restriction on seeds, and this is really part of our inspiration for this project.
So work with me for a minute and imagine the future. So obviously in the past couple decades, all this biotech genetic stuff has really accelerated. Let's fast forward another 20 or 50, even 100 years, and let's imagine that all seed data, all genetic data is open source. What are the benefits of having something like that? What are the benefits of having society based off of that?
Well, I mean, I think that's a very smart question, because there are some actually downsides to having this open source framework. One of them is that many private companies depend on the intellectual property rights as a way to make revenue. So if everything is open source, it will make it difficult for them to exert proprietary control over seeds. So I think that's one of the potential downsides. On the positive side, when it comes to things like food, which of course, agriculture is all about food production, and I think if you have a system that does promote free exchange, you're probably going to get better response to plant diseases, and you're probably going to get better crops, and I would say a better chance of feeding the population. So my sense is that open source technology will foster a kind of tinkering and a kind of ethic of sharing and saving and creating seeds that we don't really have right now, because we're breeding in silos. We're really breeding in our own proprietary programs and trying to protect that germplasm. So I think there's pluses and minuses to it. Another aspect that we've talked a lot about is what is the economic model for open source seeds. Right now we have 11 companies selling open source seeds, and they don't sell just those. They sell their own seeds, their own varieties, but they also sell some of our open source varieties. We have about 60 or 65 varieties right now that are open source in 23 different crops. And they can sell them, they believe, at a premium because they carry a sort of a unique set of characteristics. It's like selling a value-added product like fair trade or organic. In this case, it's open source. And so the economic model, I think, will be interesting to see, how it develops and whether that can be something that actually sustains a business.
That is very interesting. And, we think a lot in software of companies like Red Hat, which provides open source enterprise software. It's been very profitable for some time with that model. So it's definitely interesting to us, how that model is going to work in the future. But it seems possible.
We hope so.
Absolutely, yeah. So I wanted to kind of track back a little bit and ask a little bit about how the model works currently. So you mentioned that farmers and gardeners often have to deal with a number of licenses, but could you kind of walk through what that looks like now for maybe a commercial farmer down to a small-scale producer in dealing with licenses and dealing with or with how companies deal with these patents and other patent pools of this genetic material?
So if you're a large scale farmer and you're buying seed from a big seed company, especially if that seed is transgenic, genetically modified seed, say corn or soybeans, and most of the U.S. acreage is genetically modified, you're actually signing a technology use agreement with the company. And that technology use agreement gives the company various rights to come onto your farm to examine what seeds you're selling and saving. It actually gives them the right to test your seeds to make sure you're not saving their seeds. So it's quite restrictive. If you're growing tomatoes or cucumbers on your farm or your vegetable farm, you're probably not signing one of those agreements, but you may very well be buying a patented variety. And so that patented variety has a number of characteristics in terms of its restrictions on it that you may be beholden to simply by buying that variety. If you're a very small farmer or gardener, you may very well be buying seed from catalogs that doesn't come with any particular restrictions. And some of those varieties may in fact be in the public domain. Those are the varieties that we're using in the Open Source Seed Initiative to breed new varieties. So we're really using material that is not in any way restricted, material that's in the public, sometimes heirloom varieties, and those are the materials that really are today's really only freely available things.
With that said, and what you mentioned a minute ago, the patenters usually are tied to, you know, the opposition is against genetic modification in general, and I wanted to know how that has affected this project of yours. Have you received a lot of harsh feedback or criticism because of genetic modification, or is this something where what you're doing is so unique and it really appeals to a certain audience that that blowback hasn't really occurred?
Well, none of the varieties that we have in the program are genetically modified. And we have decided that right now we don't want to accept any genetically modified varieties in the Open Source Seed Initiative. You know, I think many of the people that are interested in open source seeds are also not interested in using genetically modified varieties, and so we sort of feel like the main sort of customer base or clientele base for our project right now wouldn't really fit with genetically modified. That said, we've had some really interesting conversations about what if somebody developed an open source GMO crop variety and would we accept it and how would that work? And so those are conversations that we're continuing to have. I'm not really sure how that's all going to shake out, but it's been very, very interesting to have those conversations.
I'm actually quite interested in sort of some of the varieties you're working on right now. Obviously, you're dealing with a lot of heirloom material, genetic material, and not so much kind of quite different things with GMOs. What are some of the more interesting varieties you and your team are working on right now that you see have a lot of potential in, you think would have a lot of adoption as far as use by farmers or gardeners or other seed savers?
Well, we definitely have some really fantastic varieties of crops. Like, for example, we have some lettuces that come from Frank Morton. Frank is a farmer and a plant breeder out in Oregon, and he really has developed some of the finest lettuces in the United States. And he decided to put some of those in the open source project. And some of those are just, you know, gorgeous colors and, you know, really subtle textures and flavors. So, I mean, you could find a gardener could go on our website, which is osseeds.org. They could find those lettuces and they could order seed from Frank and get some of the best lettuces around. We also have kind of an interesting collection of varieties that are really much more popular in other parts of the world. There's a huge interest in this in the developing world. We have some oca varieties. We have some quinoa varieties. We have varieties that wouldn't even grow well in the United States. And I think it shows that there are a lot of people out there who are interested in this sort of thing. And finally, I could say that we have been developing some seeds that are essentially germplasm pools. They're not varieties, but rather they're open pollinated varieties that contain lots of diversity. And we're making those available through the Open Source Seed Project, not really as a finished variety, but sort of like getting a kit. It's like getting a kit of diverse seeds in a packet. And then you grow that in your environment and you select out the things that you think will be most useful. So it's like a breed your own vegetable variety at home project.
How and this is a little bit of a different question, but how has the reaction been among the agricultural community toward this project? Because when you hear open source, again, like I mentioned earlier, it's really geared towards software. And I'm wondering how they understand it, and someone who has no background with software might embrace something like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been an interesting sort of reaction. I mean, it's quite diverse. Some people really, you know, latch onto the concept and can see right away that it's sort of fosters some tinkering, and you know, they can see how that would be useful. Other people are haven't embraced it, whether because sometimes they feel that, you know, I think that the protection of a variety, especially something that you spend, you know, a plant variety can take 10 years, 12 years to create. So, you know, people in the plant breeding world and even in other parts of agriculture will say, you know, once you spend that much effort on it, why would you be willing to release it open source and let have somebody just sort of deconstruct it? You know, we sort of make these creations, they're almost like art projects by the time you get done with them. So, I mean, we've had lots of interesting reaction. I think by and large, though, the response has been positive simply because many people in agriculture are concerned about this sort of increasing intellectual property rights problem. And so they understand the need to create a little pool of germplasm that's not necessarily going to be subject to those same restrictive rules.
So do you think that there is some parallels to be drawn between the seed industry and the sort of agriculture industry and the software industry, which is where the open source philosophy has become so prevalent?
I don't know. You know, I don't know enough about the software industry to really probably give you an intelligent answer there. Agriculture is so, and there's so many unique things about agriculture because of the sort of fundamental basic needs that people have for food and fiber. But perhaps one could draw some parallels with the software industry. I think certainly the consolidation that goes on in those industries is probably a parallel. And certainly the relatively high technology reliance and also, you know, the money needed to make the investments to do that technology is probably another parallel. But it's hard for me to sort of assess it beyond that.
So for our listeners who are maybe more familiar with software but less familiar with agriculture, who are some of the biggest players out there right now, both in any kind of open source, this burgeoning open source movement, who I suppose is probably going to be a smaller community, as well as some of the larger agricultural technology companies working in this area?
Well, in terms of, are you asking about the agricultural companies who are involved in plant breeding and seeds?
Correct, yeah. I would say plant breeding, seed distribution, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, there are several very large companies that are global now. Monsanto is one of the largest, of course, in the world, but so is DuPont Pioneer. A third one is Syngenta, which is based in Switzerland. And then Limagran is a French farmers cooperative that's, I think, recognized as one of the top four in the world. Those companies own, you know, maybe as much, depending on the crop, they may own 75% of the varieties for some of the crops that are grown around the world. So they really, those four companies have a quite huge market share. But there are some other smaller companies, and we're finding in the open source project, what we're finding is that it's the very small companies that are looking for, many of them use freelance breeders, and much smaller groups of clients that they work with that tend to have the greatest interest in the open source project. So right now it's very much a sort of a small company focus. We have had one large company contact us and express an interest and beginning to offer some open source crop varieties. And that would be incredibly exciting. It's a company from Europe. It'd be incredibly exciting if they went ahead and did that. I mean, they would be offering them alongside their conventional varieties, but it would be really interesting to see if that develops. And we're going to be following that very closely.
Earlier, you mentioned something, and it kind of caught my ear when you were talking about how some of the seed companies have actually tested the seeds to make sure that, you know, they're not using them unauthorized. And I was curious about enforcement on that and if there was any specific litigation that you know, the intellectual property has been abused and it really, and I don't know if abuse is the best one, I would say enforce. So they've actually, you know, followed this and tested them and there was either, it went to court or there was a big, you know, a big to-do about it. Has this happened a lot or is this something that really does happen rarely?
No, there's quite a bit of litigation around this subject, I think actually quite frequently. And if you I mean, there's some very high-profile cases of the companies going into farmers' fields, taking samples of tissue, running DNA analysis, and litigation following that. There's some very, very high-profile cases. And so it is something that farmers talk about, you know, is the sort of the way that they're subject to all the rules. And I totally understand the company defending its patents. I'm not against that. It's just that the climate is so different than it ever was in agriculture. And I think this is one of the things that we've had farmers say to us is, you know, I really would like to just grow a crop and not have to worry, you know, that I'm somehow infringing on somebody's patent, or that pollen from my neighbor is drifting over onto my field, causing an infringement. And I think, you know, the freedom to sort of do these things without being contacted by lawyers is something I completely understand.
So I'm going to bring it back to the software industry a little bit and just sort of think about all of the implications that this would have if we were still stuck in the proprietary era of software. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you think could be done to change the agricultural industry in perhaps the same in a similar way that the software industry has moved away from monetizing intellectual property?
Boy, you know, I think one of the things that always causes people to take a second look at intellectual property control is when there are major problems with crops, so major diseases, major famines, major issues, where the solution to the problem has to do with genetic diversity. And if the solution to the agricultural problem has to do with genetic diversity, then I think we have to take a close look at the proprietary models and ask whether they're really, you know, allowing us to access genetic diversity. So that's one thing, I think. Another is, you know, I think that there's a sort of a consumer backlash against the big companies and the genetically modified crops, and there's a lot of interest in organics. There's a lot of interest in sustainable production. And a lot of the people interested in those things see the seed issues as being also important. So that, you know, encouraging sort of the development of those groups will make probably a big difference. And so we'll see if any, you know, we'll see if these things come to pass. But those are two trends that I note and that we're sort of following.
So one of the key arguments we see in favor of open source software, again to draw that parallel because there are so many, is that having open source code actually allows people to audit and review what's going into the programs they're running. And I imagine this mm-hmm. is a smart thing for seeds. You want to understand the genetic material you're using. You want to understand sort of the source and the potential for it as a crop. And I'm interested in sort of wondering how do we reach farmers and how do we educate people as to the importance of understanding the importance of that, of knowing why they want to have open source, why they want to be able to sort of review the source code, quote unquote, of their genetic material.
That is a really interesting question. I mean, in some ways, I think it's almost a futuristic question. We're not quite there yet because looking into the code is not. It's almost not possible yet. I mean, the genetic technology is there, the sequencing technology is there, but very few farmers, probably almost no farmers, would yet be at the point where they would be able to do that and understand it. So, right, I mean, 100 years from now, 50 years from now, maybe those code readers will be available on farms so that people would be able to see that code. And I think that is probably the future. Right now, the only people that really understand it is the scientists. And or at least have access to that the sequencing machines, but I think that will enable people to actually take seeds, or take a little piece of a seed, or take a leaf and read the code and understand what's in it. That is futuristic technology that I hope will come to pass. And it's interesting that you ask it because right now, if the seed is patented, that research that one would do on the code is prohibited. So the patented seeds, you're not allowed, a farmer is not even allowed to study them, which I think is really a crazy situation. And I think that's one of the things that the Open Source Project hopes to do is to make these seeds available for people to do whatever they want with them, whether they want to sequence them and study them or use them or share them or save them. So it's a very interesting landscape right now.
You just mentioned one of my favorite topics, which is the future. I love talking about anything technology. So I wanted to follow up with that. A little bit, and ask if there's any kind of a potential for an equivalent to the Human Genome Project in the genetic material for seeds. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Human Genome Project, but it's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. So please let us know.
Well, definitely. I mean, in each crop right now, there are major genome projects. I mean, the corn, there's a corn genome project, there is a soybean genome project, and there's a, right now I'm involved in my building, some of the people who are working on a carrot genome project. So each crop has a major genome, and it's either been, you know, sequenced in a draft stage, or they're actually refining those sequences now. And so there are multiple, and many of these are consortia that are from scientists around the world. So I think, you know, in many ways, I think we're doing some of the same things that the animal genomes are doing, trying to understand these genomes. That work will go on for decades right now, but that's really a cutting-edge sort of frontier for us.
How is it that you think that people in the community, both within the agricultural community, I know that some of our listeners, for example, are in fact farmers in some capacity, and people in the larger community, especially some of our listeners who in other cases are musicians or software engineers or even entrepreneurs, how can people help out with this project?
Well, thank you for asking. That's really kind. And I think there are many ways. I mean, one of them is to look at osseeds.org. And osseeds.org has a number of ways people can participate. For one, you know, people might have access to varieties that they would like to donate. They may have a family variety or an heirloom that's in their family that they could donate to the project. There's a mechanism for donation. We've recently created a kind of partnership for food companies. There's a lot of interest in producing open source food, which would come from open source seed. And so we have our first now food company partner that's working on sort of figuring out how to do that. People could access it from that side of things. Another great way for people to get involved is to order some seeds from some of the companies that sell these open source seeds, and not only grow them in their gardens, or in their fields, but actually save seeds of them and share them with others. So, I mean, I think all of those things are active ways people can get involved.
So, Erwin, it's been absolutely a pleasure to have you on the show today. It's been really really fun to chat about this topic, which we kind of don't venture into very often, which is agriculture, but something we've talked about before on the show, and we've been excited to have you. So I wanted to wrap up with one final question, which is sort of, so far, you've summarized a bit of this so far, but can you tell us a little bit about the successes you've seen with the project so far and the plans you have going forward?
Well, we've distributed over 6,000 seed packets during the first year of operation. We started last spring of 14, and those 6,000 seed packets went to 16 different countries. So I think, you know, some of the success has been just the great interest in getting these seeds and the number of places in the world that have interest. Another is the expansion of the number of varieties. We now have over 60 varieties of 23 crops, and so I think that's another big plus, that the sort of catalog of Aussie varieties continues to expand. And finally, the fact that we now have 11 companies who are selling these seeds is a sign that there could be a little bit of an economic model for a remunerative way to do this. And so all those things, I think, have contributed. We made a 501c3 out of it, so we are now a charitable organization, a nonprofit organization. That's another plus. And so all of these things, I think, are signs that hopefully this project will expand in the future.
All right, Erwin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a fascinating conversation. Is there any other things that you want to share with our community before we close the show?
Boy, I mean, you guys have asked great questions, and I think I so appreciate being included. I mean, the only thing I would say in concluding is that I, you know, my university has been very generous with me in allowing me to develop some varieties that can be released through the open source project. But I recognize that even as a public scientist, some of the varieties that I develop will be patented and licensed. That's the way the institutions work today. So I guess I would say that this project will never represent the majority of my effort, even as a public scientist, but even if it can represent a small portion of my effort, I think I can, hopefully my colleagues can, contribute to an ever-expanding pool of seed that will remain free. And that's really what we hope this will result in.
Erwin Goldman, the Department Chair and Professor of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin, and a visionary himself. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.